I'm skeptical of the idea that we'll one day all be walking around with very accurate, very portable, lightweight monitoring devices that are going to read everything that we say. So it was a wooden box with this battery used at home, and it was sold to cure hundreds of different ailments. And people would turn it on, hold the two electrodes in their hands, or either place them at different places on their bodies to get a shock. It was called taking a shock. Like, you take your medicine, you would take a shock.
This is Brain Inspired.
Welcome, everyone. I am Paul Middlebrooks. Are you right now running current from a 9-volt battery through your head? Are you wearing an EEG cap while you monitor your own brain waves? Do you just enjoy listening to people talk about this kind of stuff? Well, you're in the right place today. Anna Wexler is a postdoc at UPenn, where she studies the world of neurotechnology, and especially direct-to-consumer neurotechnology. That is, gadgets, apps, and the like, currently marketed and sold without regulation, that you can buy and self-administer at home to try to enhance your own cognitive abilities, abilities like playing a musical instrument, improving your working memory, getting better at meditating, and so on. Or you can try to treat your depression or any number of cognitive ailments. Anna has an interesting background. She, starting as an undergraduate, co-wrote, directed, produced, and edited a documentary film called Unorthodox, about how spending a year in Orthodox Jewish studies in Israel transforms American, rather unorthodox, Jewish teenagers, although there's a lot more subtext throughout the film. She has traveled a ton and written extensively about neuroscience and more, including a lot about what we'll talk about today. Most of her academic work has focused on transcranial direct current stimulation, which is pumping tiny currents into your head, like I described a moment ago. But she has wide interests and knowledge, which we also explore. We talk about what neurotechnology is and how it's tricky to define, the industry of cognitive enhancement with its different products and claims about what those products can do for your brain, how those products might be regulated, what kinds of people are using them in their homes. And of course, we didn't cover the extent of it. You can learn more about her work through her website, AnnaWexler.com, or follow her on Twitter at Anna_Wexler. And all of this you can also find in the show notes at braininspired.co/podcast/20. A special thank you this week to another generous listener, Satpreet. Thank you for supporting the show through Patreon. If you, dear listener, find value in this little journey and would like to support the show for as little as $2 per month, go to braininspired.co and click the red Patreon button there. And you know, for every new supporter, I get to say to my wife, "See, I told you." Okay, happy self-stimulating, everyone. Since Anna was asking me questions as well along the way, here is my somewhat more personally revealing conversation with Anna. All right, Anna Wexler, welcome to the podcast and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I think that I have this right. You can tell me where I'm wrong here. So it was a rainy night and you were sitting in your editing room and you're putting the final touches on the edits for your documentary Unorthodox. You strap on your transcranial direct current stimulator. You flip a switch on and you have this epiphany. You've got to get back into academia. But you think to yourself, what should I study? And suddenly you detect the smell of burning flesh and you realize it's your own. The brain stimulator, it's burning you. And you have your second epiphany. I need to study neurotechnology, you think. That's how it all worked, right?
It would have been nice if it worked like that. You know, ending one project and starting a new one. The reality was that the documentary film I was working on, Unorthodox, that took 9 years that extended into my PhD.
Holy cow.
So it's not like I finished it and then decided to do a PhD.
That's a labor of love.
It was a labor of love. Yeah, definitely a labor of love. But I was living, and so at the time I was working on the film, I was living in Tel Aviv and working as a freelance science and travel writer. And I was writing, so I was working mostly with neuroscientists and writing about neuroscientists and neuroscience research. And one of the things that really interested me was brain-computer interfaces and the potential impact that they would have on society. And so I decided I wanted to do my own. So I saw the PhD or a PhD as a way to spend more time doing in-depth research on a project. Whereas as a freelance writer, I was, you know, commissioned to write certain articles, just short articles. Anyway, the short of it is I applied to do a PhD at MIT in the History, Anthropology, Science, Technology, and Society department, thinking I wanted to study brain-computer interfaces. Got into the program, started the PhD, realized there wasn't really enough meat yet there in the brain BCI world for me to do a PhD. It was, you know, the stuff that I'd been reading was very speculative. And at the same time, I began to hear about the do-it-yourself brain stimulation movement. And I thought, oh, that would be a great idea for a thesis. This is something that's happening right now, something that I could study kind of from a sociological perspective. So that's kind of the long story of how I got into studying what I studied.
And you actually, I mean, after you got your undergraduate degree, and then you took this 5 year, it's not a break because you were working and traveling and writing about travel and about science, which puts you kind of like me because I had probably 6 years before I started my PhD. And were you one of the older PhD candidates in your program? This is completely for my satisfaction here.
Yeah, I was one of the older candidate in my program. And I think you see a lot of people coming in straight out of their undergraduate degree, coming into their PhD because they're not quite sure what else to do. And then not all of those people, but I see some of them kind of flounder, you know, at a certain time in the middle of the PhD. They think, is this really what I want to do? You know, things like that. But I think when you have time outside of academia and then you come back, you can be a bit more focused. That's not necessarily true in all cases.
But I agree. I mean, the people who went straight from undergraduate are the people who either dropped out or were miserable or both, you know, often.
Often, yeah. I'd say often. Not always, you know, you could go either way.
No, that's true. I was jealous of the people who really shone, you know, coming right from undergrad.
Yeah, I mean, they're younger, right? If they're superstars, they'll get everything done earlier. They'll get, you know,
well,
if they get it.
There is that kind of shining, but I just meant internally shone. You know, they're happy to be there.
Okay. What did you do? Is this like a Alec Baldwin where we like chat back and forth?
Yeah, we can. Alec Baldwin.
Okay. What's his podcast? Here's the thing.
Oh, I don't know. He had a podcast. Yeah, he seems like a pretty busy guy, I guess. Yeah. We can chat back and forth. I mean, mainly
is this more like a conversation or is this like you asking questions of me? I'm happy to have a go either way.
It's in between, I think, but it's more on the me asking questions of you. But feel free to ask me anything. I'll edit it out if I think my stuff is boring. So, you know.
Okay. Well, you probably have a bias to think your stuff is boring, even though it may not be.
Pretty heavy bias.
What did you do for the 6 years?
Oh, well, I was a poor undergraduate student, and so I knew I wouldn't be able to get into graduate school anyway, and I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I got an undergraduate degree, and I kind of dropped out of aerospace engineering, ended up in a molecular biology undergraduate degree. They didn't have neuroscience in my at University of Texas, where I was doing undergraduate, back in the 60s. So I worked in a clinical laboratory for a while, and when I decided...
You weren't doing undergrad in the 60s.
I'm joking, yeah.
Okay.
When I decided I wanted to go to graduate school, I realized my GPA wasn't good enough, and I'd have to work in laboratories to do so. So I got really lucky. This woman, Carol Odie, took a chance on me and hired me into her laboratory as a technician. So I worked in her lab, and then I worked my way toward neuroscience labs. And then I had great letters of recommendation to get to grad school. So a lot of it was working toward getting into graduate school, but I wasted a good few years there not knowing what I was doing.
It sounds like fun having different lab experience along the way.
It was valuable.
Yeah.
Okay. Enough about me. So what I consider what you do.
I kind of just want to ask you about your RV trip, but yeah, this is not that. Not about me.
Hey, well, we can have another Skype a later time.
We can get into that later.
Yeah. So what I consider that you do, among other things, is really what you're studying is sociology and culture. And you study the ethical concerns therein and, you know, how regulation should proceed in these matters. But this is pretty uncharted territory. I don't know if you'd call it a new sociology and a new culture. So there's lots to think about here.
You mean the topic is uncharted or?
The regulation and ethical concerns of the technology, that, like neurotechnology that is being used today, and especially being used direct to consumer, people self-stimulating at home. But so you can tell me what you, if you agree or disagree with what I said, and then just define neurotechnology for us, if you could.
So you started with the hardest question, is how do you define neurotechnology? It's a really tough question, right? Because you could say it's a technology that affects the brain in some way, or that utilizes results from neuroscience research or something like that,
right,
to impact the brain. But then, you know, if you look at it, every thing affects the brain in some way. My computer, you know, affects the brain. When I'm sitting and writing an email, right, that's affecting my brain function. So I would say I don't have a definition of neurotechnology.
Maybe that's one of the problems, huh? The challenges.
Yeah, that's certainly one of the challenges. I have worked recently in a paper that's under review to come up with a definition of direct-to-consumer neurotechnology.
Huh.
So the way we define it in a recent paper that we have under review is the set of products, and by that we mean devices, software, and applications that are marketed and sold directly to consumers without necessitating the physician as intermediary. And they're marketed for the purposes of modulating cognition or affective or mental states.
Okay. I think that's a pretty good definition.
Yeah. And we say here is that what distinguishes these products as neurotechnologies is that they appeal to the fruits of the brain and cognitive sciences. So this is not like, let's say, a crystal that you can buy in Sedona that may be marketed to improve your brain function, right? Because you could argue that could be a neurotechnology too, in the, at least in the way that it's marketed. But the products that I've been interested in looking at are ones that really appeal to neuroscience, that are kind of sold with an aura of science, and specifically brain science.
Oh, you said aura right after you're talking about the crystals. Very nice.
There you go.
Okay, so that encompasses a lot of what we're going to talk about today. And in recent years, you know this better than I do, but money has been flowing into, for one, brain stimulation devices, transcranial direct current stimulation. But the money that's been flowing into that is relatively low with respect to other neurotechnology. It's like brain training games, you know, like Luminosity and brain enhancing.
Lumosity,
yeah.
Yeah.
And brain enhancing drugs like the nootropics world. Before we talk about the self-stimulating, people at home stimulating their brains and stuff, just in the overall big picture, what's your take on like brain training games and the nootropics and that industry and all of it?
I guess I think about them in different ways. So, I mean, so when I think of brain training games, I just think of their main struggle, which has been, you know, you can improve on one task, right? You train on one task, you can improve on that task. Are those benefits, you know, or is that improvement generalizable to other tasks? And I think that's been the main outstanding question with brain training games. So for me, it's not a yay or nay. It's, you know, if it's generalizable, then sure, why
yeah.
not? But it may not be. And I don't think there's good evidence yet that it is in all domains. And it's a difficult question to ask and to assess. And what does it mean to be generalizable? And how do you even identify the domain that you're, you know, generalizing to? And how do you study it? I mean,
yeah.
So that's like the first thing that comes to mind when I think about the brain training world.
That's interesting because the brain training game world, it's interesting because I just had Dean Bonomono on the show a couple episodes ago now, and he researches time and how it works in the brain. And he, I don't know if we talked about it, but it's known that you can, like if you want to guess a 50 millisecond interval, right? You can practice that and you can improve at guessing the 50 millisecond interval, but that doesn't generalize to the 100 millisecond interval or any other interval. You can only improve on that one interval. So even in a domain like time, it's a very specific improvement that happens. So
yeah, that's actually really fascinating.
I agree.
So that's what I think about with brain training games. And so Lumosity and a few other companies got in trouble a few years ago with the Federal Trade Commission because they were making certain claims that, according to the FTC, wasn't substantiated by evidence. So what you see now is they tone down their claims. So they don't claim that their product will improve your cognitive function. They'll say things like, actually, I don't know exactly what they say.
Because you're not a sleazy marketer. That's why you don't know. You can't come up with...
But they've toned down, they've certainly toned down their claim. So that's what I think in the brain training world. So now you'll see, if you look at the major players in that market, you'll see these kind of watered down claims. Nootropics, I'll say, I've sort of been tangentially familiar with them. It's not an area that I've studied specifically. So I don't know a lot about them. But I will say, in general, the supplement world is very interesting because, and, you know, nootropics are supplements. Because they're very lightly regulated. They're almost not regulated at all. So FDA doesn't oversee what's inside them, whether it's safe, whether it's effective. So if you go to CVS or you go to the mall and you see a GNC, all those products that are on the shelves, nobody really knows what's in them. There's nobody overseeing what's in them. And if what's claimed to be in them is actually in them. And there's actually a great website called Consumer Lab. They're a company that tests what's inside supplements and whether the supplement manufacturers are, whether what the supplement manufacturers claim that's in them is actually in them. So it's a great website. And the more I learn about supplements, the more scared I get, I will say.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is a really concerning area that people are being, having to go to emergency rooms because they've taken certain supplements or there've been too much of a certain compound in a supplement that causes problems.
I mean, that's where, like, most of the money is flowing into. Anyway, you know, the biggest industry players are the brain training games and the nootropics, I guess you say.
I would say that the biggest industry right now is, I mean, judging by amount of money that's been invested, is probably in the consumer-facing, potential for consumer-facing BCIs. So Facebook's invested a bunch of money in brain-computer interface, Neuralink.
Yeah, right. But those aren't like products yet. I guess I'm thinking
they're
more
not products.
Of products.
Yeah. They're not on the market. So yes. So yes, those are the bigger players for sure.
Okay. So let's shift a little bit. And you've written a lot about transcranial direct current stimulation. So let's talk about that in this realm here. So you want to just talk briefly about what it is? What is transcranial direct current stimulation?
Sure. TDCS, transcranial direct current stimulation, is a technique, a method of brain stimulation that sends low levels of current through the head.
We're talking like AA battery levels or a 9-volt battery levels often.
9-volt battery, yeah. There's some debate over whether it's actually sending current into the brain and not being shunted through the scalp.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the going consensus has been that it is sending very low levels of current to the brain.
Good. So the idea really is that it's putting your neurons in a slightly depolarized state so that it's getting them more ready to fire. So if you're putting current through a certain area of your brain, say that's great at backflips, then you're going to be you're ready to do a better backflip if you have the TDCS stimulator going, right?
Yes. And the converse is thought to be true for the inhibitory effect. So that might be true for the anode. So the area, the brain region beneath where the current is thought to be flowing into the brain, or the brain region beneath where the anode, the other one electrode is placed. So the current's flowing in through the anode and out through the cathode. So
right.
In the region beneath the anode, it's thought that there's a depolarizing effect. But in the region beneath the cathode where the current's flowing out, there may be a converse effect where maybe making it harder for you to perform backflips.
Yeah, you land on your face.
If both were on the motor cortex, that's not usually the case.
Well, right, but we really don't know.
But that's a very simplistic view, and that's the working model right now, but it's complicated by a variety of other things, like what drugs you're on.
Oh, sure, shockingly. So
yeah.
It is being used a lot in the academic world. It's being studied a lot. In fact, the last lab that I worked for, I overlapped just a little bit. They were just starting some work using TDCS in non-human primates.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and trying to track, you know, to see if behavioral changes ensued. This is like an eye movement lab. But how you know how it's used in the academic world. How do people use TDCS in the academic world?
So it really breaks down into two kinds of studies. So studies in clinical populations and studies in healthy population. So it's in clinical studies, it's used to see if there's any effect for treating things like depression or chronic pain or schizophrenia or autism. I'd say the most promising evidence right now seems to be for depression and chronic pain. Mm-hmm. Could probably find a study that's tried TDCS for pretty much every disease or disorder that you can name.
They're cheap. They're cheap for labs to buy, too.
They're cheap for labs to buy. Yep. And I think it's important to mention it's an experimental technique. It's not FDA approved to treat any indication. So this is not a product that's on the market that you'll go to your doctor and receive.
Right.
So still experimental. So there's clinical populations, clinical studies on the one hand, and then scientists interested in understanding cognition and behavior also use it in healthy populations. So to study the effects on language, memory, motor skills, creativity, executive function, things like that. And in that literature, you'll find a lot of studies claiming that TDCS has a kind of cognitive enhancement effect.
And so there's a lot of overlap, actually, with people using it in their homes. So you can buy these things direct to consumer, have them shipped to your house. I don't know if they come with instruction manuals.
Some do, some don't.
Oh, is that right? So how do people use it at home? And there is a lot of overlap with what you just said.
Yeah, so at home, so basically the home use of TDCS breaks down in the same way that the scientific use does. So partially for treatment. In a study I did, I found that about 40% of users utilized it for treatment, and I believe there were about 3/4 that utilized it for some kind of cognitive enhancement effect. So
that also broke down really nicely along male and female, because all the males used it for cognitive enhancement and all the females used it for depression.
Yes.
Right?
Not all, but more. Well, yeah. More males than females and vice versa.
It's interesting.
Yeah. So that was a pretty interesting finding.
So, okay. So people are buying these things at home. So it's recent. This most recent surge is recent. So when did people start really buying these things and experimenting with themselves at home?
So I've traced the start of the whole idea of home users, using these things on themselves back to late 2011, early 2012, which was when the do-it-yourself TDCS movement started to coalesce.
Is that when the maker movement really took off too? I can't remember.
It was a little before that.
Okay.
I think that the maker movement. So I think the seeds were in place for, the maker movement was there before that. DIY bio had just started.
Mm.
And DIY TDCS comes a little bit after that.
Okay.
But it's interesting to think about, all these movements and kind of arising at the same time, because there is some overlap between them. So it started late 2011, early 2012, and that's when we see a Reddit forum dedicated to TDCS. There's websites and blogs and videos that come out dedicated to TDCS. And at this time, people were still making devices at home. So most of the content that you would see was, how to make a TDCS device, go to Radio Shack when Radio Shack still existed, buy the parts, put them together, here's the diagrams. Late, I think it was summer 2013 was when the first wearable device came out. And by wearable, I mean you didn't have to put anything together. You could just put it right on your head. This was the Focus version 1. Prior to that, there had been, in earlier 2013 and 2012, there had been a number of individuals, entrepreneurial individuals, who decided to start selling TDCS device kits. So they would, package a battery and some wires together, and you would just basically plug everything in at home. But the Focus device was this kind of sleek-looking headset. You could just put it out, pull it out of the box, put it on your head, and it connected to your phone. So that was about 2013. And now, I haven't checked in the last year, but I'd say there's probably at least a dozen, maybe 20 devices that are on the market sold for TDCS.
So you've written about how this is actually cyclical. The idea of pumping electricity through various parts of our body, but our brains is not new. So you've written about the medical battery. So what is that? What's the medical battery? And when was that?
So the medical battery is very interesting. So that was the late 1800s, early 1900s. And the use of electricity at home at that time was extremely popular. So if you could put yourself back in that time period.
Was Tesla alive? I can't remember. Was Tesla alive at that point? Edison?
Tesla.
Was that later? I have it all mixed up.
Yeah, I'm not.
Because, home electricity.
Well, yes, I guess it was, because electricity was making its way into the home, into the homes of Americans. I should say I'm talking about the United States when I talk about
right.
This. Yeah. It was making its way into the homes in the late 1800s and early 1900s, like the last decade or two of the 1800s. So it started in the wealthier homes. They had electricity first. And then it, you know, gradually moved its way to other people's, you know, so it gradually spread.
Okay.
So the medical battery was not something that was plugged into the wall. It actually came to seem sort of outdated once there was electricity, widespread electricity in people's homes. But yeah, so at this time, electricity was very, very exciting. It was in the 20s and 30s that alternating current was discovered and that the precursor to a battery was discovered then. So this was in the early 1800s. So suddenly you had a way to both store, to generate electricity, to store it and release it on demand.
Yeah.
So that was the early part of the 1800s. And that kind of really paved the way for certain actually, people had been interested in medical electricity since static electricity, which was the middle of the 1700s, since that was, I don't want to say discovered, because people knew about static electricity before that. But
right.
But since there were ways to capture it and kind of play with it, that was in the mid-1700s. Anyway, yeah, so early 1800s, alternating current now exists, direct current now exists. At the time, they called direct current galvanic current after Galvani. Alternating current was ferritic current after Faraday. So these devices exist that can generate and store electricity, and people began using them for medical purposes and essentially trying to cure different ailments with electricity. And it was thought that electricity would loosen any blockages that you had in your system. It would sort of get things flowing. And so the real heyday of these home medical batteries, which were devices that were probably about the size of a shoebox, is the best way to describe them. They're heavy wooden things with batteries were much larger back then. So today you have a AA battery that's, you know, quite small, maybe the size of your pinky, let's say,
right,
depending on how big your pinky is. Back then, I would say the batteries that were used in these devices were about the size of a really big burrito. Like think of the biggest burrito that you could buy that's stocked full with everything. That's the size of that these batteries were. So it was a wooden box with this battery used at home, and it was sold to cure hundreds of different ailments. And people would turn it on, hold the two electrodes in their hands, or either place them at different places on their bodies to get a shock. It was called taking a shock. Like you take your medicine, you would take a shock.
Oh man, I want to go take a shock now. See what happens. Loosen up whatever's tight inside me.
Yeah, there are hundreds of companies selling these devices, so this was a big business. So it was something you could go see your doctor to get. You know, you could get electrical medicine, or you could buy a device for use at home as well.
Okay, now we just get oxycodone and stuff, right? So you know, just
yes, well, that's, yeah. Yes.
So you argue rightly so. I think that self-stimulating should be understood in terms of like the larger context of like DIY, do it yourself, and citizen science and life hacking movements. Why is that? Why do you think that it should be understood in this larger umbrella?
Well, I think there's just a lot of similarity. I mean, there's similarities and differences between the movements. So I think understanding where the movements are similar and where they might be different is useful for thinking about policy, you know, how to navigate the rise of DIY medical or DIY science movements. So one main difference, let's say, between DIY bio and DIY TDCS is in DIY biology, it's mostly groups of people coming together, often around a shared space, and they're experimenting, but they're doing it not to improve themselves. They're doing it for tinkering, to make cool stuff, maybe to do some experiments that they're interested in. But in DIY TDCS, the people are, the DIYers are motivated by self-improvement. So whether they're using it for enhancement or they're using it for treatment, they're trying to improve themselves in some way. So the movements are very similar in many ways, but I think there's also these underlying differences in motivation.
Okay.
And I think so that can inform policy in terms of if you're making policy for, you know, if you're trying to restrict someone doing something, just, you know, if someone's doing it for kicks, right, and you're trying to restrict them, that's one thing. But if you're trying to restrict somebody who's really desperate and is trying to self-treat, let's say their depression, that's intractable, that person's going to go to much greater lengths to try and use that device or use that technology than someone who's, you know, not as personally motivated.
These are hard questions. I'm glad that you're thinking about these things instead of me. So with TDCS in particular, what are the dangers or unintended consequences of using it?
Burning is one. That's reported by a small number of users.
Did they not wet the sponge? What? How do you get burned? I don't understand.
So some of the early devices, I won't name the company's names, but the electrode size was very small. And, you know, sometimes there's no directions to wet the sponge, or you wet it with water instead of saline solution.
Right.
Or the electrodes are really small. But usually if you're aware that burning is a risk, you should be able to feel that, you know, there's something getting very hot on your forehead, unless you're very distracted, which you might be. But there's also burns reported in the scientific literature. If you look there, there's redness, there's burns, there's headaches, there's tingling. And that's what home users also report, similar issues.
Yeah.
The unknown, so I'd say the main unknown. Well, actually, I'll start by saying that home users actually don't deviate too much from the parameters that are used in the laboratory settings in a number of ways. In one way, they deviate a lot. So when it comes to current level, they mostly stay at around 2 milliamps, which is roughly what's used in scientific studies. In terms of length of session, 15 to 20 minutes is the most common, which is also probably the most common in scientific studies. But where they depart is in the number of sessions that they have used TDCS for. So in laboratory studies of TDCS, especially for cognitive enhancement, so in healthy populations, there's often only one or two.
You can't get undergraduates to come back to the lab.
Yeah, like more than a few times, right?
Right.
Clinical studies are sometimes a bit more, but home users really, at least some of them, stimulate a lot more frequently. And so it's unknown, you know, what that level of stimulation does, or what chronic stimulation, what the effects of chronic stimulation like that are.
Somewhat related to that as well, it's unknown the long-term effects of these things as well, in terms of, let's say that you stimulate and you do learn piano faster, right? But you don't know what you're unlearning, you don't know what you're becoming worse at. So increasing the neural synchrony, for instance, in one part of your brain, well, more resources are devoted to that part of the brain. And you just, for one thing, like you said, on the other end of the electrical device, those neurons are more hyperpolarized, less active. And so whatever area that is, maybe that's getting worse. But even beyond that, when you train for one thing, you might become worse at other things. And it's just such an open subject that it's really impossible to say what could be going on.
Yeah, and some have argued that there's the brain is it's like a zero sum game where
right.
You know, if you're improving one area, you may be doing that at the cost of the detriment of another.
Yeah,
but it's unknown. It could be that when I text on my phone, I am, you know, by devoting my resources to that, I could be doing that at the detriment to something else. So it could be that everything we do,
of course,
right,
of course,
comes with the loss of a other. Cognitive ability, not loss, but, you know, negatively affects another cognitive ability in some way.
Your ability to juggle is declining right now as you speak to me. I know. So
to juggle. Yeah. I'm not very good at juggling anyway.
Okay. So, you recently did a survey, and I think this was, I think it was your 2018 paper in the Journal of Cognitive Enhancement, where you did a survey and asked what kinds of people used transcranial direct current stimulation at home. And we've talked about this a little bit. You've asked what kinds of people use it and why do they use it? I'm surprised at this. You got 7 out of 10 companies to participate in this survey on the condition of anonymity. How did you get those 7 to participate? It seems, and they're anonymous, but it seems like they wouldn't want to participate.
Yeah. So I think that happened in two ways. One, I had published an earlier paper on the practices of do-it-yourself brain stimulation that consisted of interviews with DIYers. And I think people in the field, at least the people who ran the companies and the users, recognized that in contrast to some of the other bioethicists who are out there saying, hey guys, don't do this, you're being stupid, you're being reckless. My paper was focused on the data. I didn't reserve judgment on these individuals. I actually thought and still think that they're quite intelligent. If you're able to either make this device or do it in your home, you know, you have to have some kind of electrical knowledge or engineering ability, at least in the early stages.
Or a willingness, paired with a willingness.
Yeah, willingness to learn, right? Yeah. There was like a bar. It wasn't, you know, you had to go seek this out. But but anyway, so I think that was one reason, right? I was different than the other people. And there were a lot of people saying, don't do this. You guys are stupid. That was probably most of the voices at the time were saying something like that. So that was one piece of it. The other piece was that we shared the data with them. So they had an interest without any names.
Hmm.
So it was anonymized data from their company. So if there were 50 respondents from company X, that company got data from those 50 respondents without any identifying information.
Oh, so that's some marketing research for them, free.
Marketing research, yeah. Exactly. But they had no say in what we were going to, I mean, we piloted the survey and we sent it to people for feedback, but they had no say in what we asked, what we were going to report. There was no impact that they had on the survey. There was no financial exchanges. So it was like, we're doing a study. If you participate, you get all this extra data from your company only.
Well, I mean, it's interesting data. I mean, and actually it's pretty impressive. You sent out about around 10,000 emails to people. And you got a open rate or a response rate of almost 3.5%. Do I have that right?
Yes. It was aggregate response of 3.5 or 3.9.
That's like pretty good, normal for like email marketing, you know, so there's nothing in it for them. So that was pretty good.
Is it good for email? I mean, it's actually lower. It's a low response rate relative to other targeted studies that assess certain populations. But I think, right, relative to the amount of email that I barely open any email from companies.
Yeah, these aren't people who like signed up for your email list in particular. So this is like, these are cold emails that you're sending these people. So, I mean, that's pretty impressive. So there are around 350 people who took the survey. If it's okay, let's just talk about a few of the notable results here. So we already talked about the, about 2/3 of people used it for cognitive enhancement, right? And about 1/3 used it for something therapeutic, mostly depression, but also anxiety and ADHD. And I mentioned earlier that the fallout was the male were more often the cognitive enhancement seekers and females were more often the therapeutic seekers in that fallout.
Can I actually pause you before that point? The depression point, I think, is interesting to linger on for a second, because almost all of these products are marketed for enhancement, not for treatment. And so the fact that we found that it was almost 1/3 of users who had ever used the device. So we asked people if they used the device. So amongst those who had ever used the device at least once, about 1/3 had used it to self-treat depression. And that was a far higher number than I was expecting, because the devices aren't marketed for that purpose.
But people who are depressed, like you mentioned earlier, are desperate for respite, you know, for some relief from the depression too. So maybe they seek it out more. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
But, you know, and then... And these are overlapping numbers, because this is not going to sum to one, but 1/4 of the people also responded that they were just curious or you know, were self-experimenting or the novelty of it, for instance.
Yeah, that's also important, because in bioethics or neuroethics, we tend to categorize people as treatment or enhancement. Are they enhancing? Are they treating? I mean, it's a very tough distinction to make anyway. Like, where is the border between those two? But even just showing that not everyone who buys these devices are even using it specifically for these purposes. Some are just buying it because they think it's interesting and they want to just try it out. They heard about it.
Right, so yeah.
I think that's just interesting to keep in mind.
One of the more surprising results was that the average age of users, I would have guessed, late 20s, early 30s average, but it was 45.
Yeah.
Crazy.
You know the study very well here.
I take notes, you know.
Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah, it was very surprising, because all the media portrayals and previous study depicted the typical user as 20-something dude who's interested in cognitive enhancement and, you know, is on Reddit. And the mean age was really, just really surprising.
See, these are, like you mentioned in the paper, or you surmise, they're baby boomers, right, who are using these products. And a lot of the older users might be treating themselves for cognitive decline and trying to get back up to speed, whereas the earlier, I don't remember if it was bimodal or if it was a normal distribution.
You know, I actually think, so we had a question, did you use TDCS to enhance, treat, or restore? It wasn't asked like that.
Right.
The wording was more carefully constructed. It was, have you ever used TDCS for this purpose, for that purpose? But we did get it, treat, enhance, and restore. And so there was, I forget exactly how many it was, there was a proportion who selected restoration, so restoring cognitive abilities. And I think there was a small difference in age, but it wasn't that meaningful. We're still talking mid-40s. Mm. I don't remember exactly what it was, but...
I just thought of a caveat, though. Maybe the older participants were more likely to open an email. I'm not sure. Who knows?
Could be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And let's just run down some of the results on the effects that people perceived, at least, right? So the way that most people use this stuff, they're not actually measuring their own performance over time. They either didn't measure at all or they measured via self-observation. So there's no objectivity here, obviously.
Yeah.
And almost half of the people assessed their self-treatment as successful, as working in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little higher than I expected. But for most people, it didn't meet their expectations going in.
Yes. And I think that's reflected when you actually look at the breakdown of... So the question was, how successful did you find TDCS to be? Or some variant of that phrasing. And the answers were, on a 1 to 5 scale, very successful to unsuccessful. And then the middle was not sure. And the highest category of response was... somewhat successful. And I believe the second one was not sure. So when you have this somewhat successful, it's not people saying it's very successful. They're saying, yeah, it was probably successful. And there was a big not sure category. So what that tells me is that it's not a technology that people find to be overwhelmingly effective.
Right. And often, you know, if you're going to strap one of those on, you're going to be practicing the piano more anyway. So these could be just practice effects, et cetera. So there's a lot more to learn here, but it's really interesting stuff. It's a really interesting breakdown.
Yeah. And those who used it for treatment found it more successful as those who used it for enhancement.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that could be for a number of reasons. It could be TDCS is actually more effective for a certain treatment than for enhancement. It could be that the placebo effect is greater for treaters than for enhancers. It could be that it's equally successful, but perhaps the effects are more salient. Equally successful or unsuccessful, well, equally successful, but that the effects are more salient for people who are, say, depressed, right? So you might notice an improvement in depression more than you might notice a 5% increase on your working memory, let's say.
Right.
So it could be a lot of reasons for that. And yeah, again, it's self-report, but I think in this case, self-report is actually the interesting measure to get at.
Am I going to get you in trouble if I ask if you've self-experimented?
I've tried some of the devices. I haven't used any of them regularly. I tried the Think when it was out. I've tried a few others. I'm not sure if it had any effect. I didn't really do any kind of testing.
Self-observation
or anything,
like that. Or anything, yeah. Well, so, okay, so this is one of the things that you do in your writing a lot is consider the ethical implications and how we would begin regulating these types of things. So, Anna, how would we begin regulating these types of things?
Well, it's tough. Well, the first question is, what's the problem, right? Why would we want to regulate it, right? So instead of saying we need to regulate it, which actually is a way that some people, you know, some people are just arguing we need to regulate it.
Let's be clear. You do think we need to regulate it. Is that right?
I'm not sure that we do.
Okay. Because you write objectively about it, so it's hard to know, you know, your opinion. So.
I know. I kind of stay...
smart.
well, yes, I write about... So I'm trained in the social sciences, and there it's actually a sin to take a stand either way to say what we should do, to make a normative claim.
Sure.
So I'm trying to not do that so much anymore, especially because now I'm in a bioethics department where you actually are supposed to say what's right and what's wrong all the time. So there must be a happy medium where you don't always say what's right and what's wrong definitively as if you know the answers to everything. But yes, anyway. So in terms of regulation, yeah, so I think the starting question is really what's the harm? And so rather than starting from this is crazy, people are doing this, we should regulate it, which is what a lot of people argued, things like that. I think the starting point is, well, what are we concerned about? What are, objectively, what are the harms that people are experiencing?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's actually what motivates my sociological work, is taking these questions that are of interest to bioethics and policy and then bringing in sociology to say, like, what is the actual harm?
Yeah.
And where is there potential for harm, right? So if we look at just safety or side effects, safety and risk, these are very big terms that people define in different ways and talk about in different ways. But when we're looking at short-term, very physical side effects. It's what a lot of people mean when they talk about safety. It's that people have skin burns. A small portion of people who use these devices have skin burns.
Small price to pay, I think.
Yeah. And then you could think about unknown, you know, the unknown effects of chronic use as a potential harm. But actually, there's unknown effects of long-term use of drugs. Pretty much any drug you take, nobody studied the potential long-term cognitive impact of those. That's not assessed in standard clinical trials. Standard clinical trials assess certain outcomes and, you know, adverse events, which are really side effects, short-term physical effects that can be measured or quantified in some way.
Right.
So when you look at it like that, it's hard to point to a real overwhelming need for strict regulation, I would say, in this case. The question is, what if they were to be regulated, where would that regulation come from and who has regulatory jurisdiction over them in the U.S.? And the regulatory question is whether these devices are medical devices and therefore fall under FDA jurisdiction, or if they're consumer products and therefore they're not subject to FDA medical device laws. And so then you have to go and ask, what makes something a medical device? What is the definition of medical device? So the FDA judges whether or not something is a medical device, not by its mechanism of action, but by looking into how a marketer, a manufacturer markets the product.
So, which is great. Hang on. I just want to...
Yeah. I'll give you an example. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, just, you know, raised my ire with the marketing, because marketing's job is to get around stuff like that and to communicate in a way that you're going to buy the product and the company won't get regulated. So it's just teaching them how to market.
Yeah, I mean, you could write, so companies write around the regulation. And that's what happened with supplements too, right? So the line between what's a supplement and what's a drug is not that big. you know, the claims that supplements can make and the claims that drugs can make. So a supplement can market themselves as reducing the appearance of wrinkles, whereas a drug can market a drug. If you say you're reducing wrinkles, then that's actually a medical claim, then you're considered a drug under FDA regulation.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a softer claim, right, reducing the appearance of wrinkles, then you're a supplement. And there's very, very little oversight. You can go straight to market, be right on the shelves without showing safety or efficacy or anything like that.
I have got to get in the supplement game here. This is really...
Supplements are really crazy. So similarly with devices, it's all about how you market the device. So if you market your device for enhancement, the question is whether that's a medical claim or not. It's probably not.
But right now it's the Wild West. So there's no... I mean, that's what kind of you're working toward. When regulators catch up and they start to think about these things, they're going to be reading your papers to make these regulations. So it's an interesting position you're in.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm in contact with the FDA, and the FDA is thinking about this, and they've had several or at least one workshop on the topic. But I think for them, it's also a question of resources. You know, is this a need that they should put more effort into?
Yeah.
And so they actually have a guidance that's out, and they basically said that if a device is low risk and it's marketed for wellness purposes, not for medical indications, even though it technically could fall within their jurisdiction, they're going to exercise enforcement discretion, which basically means they're not going to bother with them. They're not going to take a look. So the question is whether TDCS devices meet this criteria. Are TDCS devices, they're certainly marketed for wellness purposes.
Right.
Are they low risk? And in the recent version of the guidance, FDA said they would not be classified as low risk. So basically, FDA was saying TDCS devices do not meet the criteria for this exemption. But at the same time, they have not taken any action against the devices, against the manufacturers. So it's a bit of a confusing point where it is now. But again, it all comes down to how a manufacturer markets a device. You know, is it for medical indications? Is it for enhancement? And so now what we're seeing in the EEG space and in other spaces is products and devices being marketed for wellness, which are sort of like the supplement, dietary supplement versions of medical devices. Like the same way that the relationship between dietary supplements and drugs and marketing is the same way that similar to the relationship between these direct-to-consumer neurotechnologies and medical devices.
My grandfather's printer went out and he needs a new printer. And my grandmother said, well, I was watching the TV and they said the best place to buy a printer is Best Buy. And it was because it was a Best Buy commercial. you know? And so like people, we're just so, I mean, she's of the older generation, but we're so...
open to influence.
Right? Yes. Thank you for that euphemism. So it's, you know, it's pretty interesting. Okay. So we don't have a ton of time left. We were going to talk about EEG and people, these direct-to-consumer EEG devices that are billed also somewhat in the same manner, in a very similar fashion. We're just going to touch on it briefly. One of the interesting things, so you've written about this as well and studied these EEG devices. So EEG is widely used in labs for researching cognitive processes, among other things, in humans. And we did EEG in monkeys as well. And for lay consumers, it's being marketed for thought control. Like, so you can think about, you can control drones, for instance, using your thoughts to control a drone and things like that. And also for brain enhancement. So you see what your EEG signature looks like and you can work on it. And you know, I think it's called a Muse. Is that the meditation device?
That's one, yeah.
So you, this neurofeedback thing, and you can make your brain patterns change by viewing and observing your own brain patterns. One of the interesting things to me out of your study about the EEG is that the overlap between EEG users and TDCS users is really minimal. So only 7% of the TDCS users also use the EEG, which is a crazy statistic to me.
You're very astute for picking up on all these points. Yes. Yeah, I thought there would be more overlap, because when you think about, when I think about direct-to-consumer technology and users of direct-to-consumer neurotechnology, you might think that someone who uses one kind of DTC neurotechnology will use another kind, but
yeah,
that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, so anyway, you know, this is a podcast about the interface between neuroscience and AI, so I'm just going to throw in there that there are machine learning techniques that are being used to analyze the EEG data that are actually more accurate in their predictions of your behaviors and cognitive processes. But the caveat is they're likely analyzing the data that's coming from your eye movements, because as you know, as we know in the EEG world, eye movements create this huge artifact, but they're also correlated with your facial expressions, with how you're feeling and stuff. So they can actually be used to infer mental states and behaviors.
Yes.
I'm just kind of getting us, flying us through the EEG world, because there's more meat there, and I'll link that paper in the show notes as well. So
can I just want to say a few more quick things just about the EEG.
Great. I mean, if you have time, that'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the EEG study was interesting in that we critiqued, my co-author, Robert Thibault, and I critiqued an area that really hadn't been, or an industry that hadn't really been critiqued before. So there's a lot of people talking about brain stimulation, home use of brain stimulation, and there's been a lot of talk of brain training games, whether they work, and the FTC has gotten involved. But I feel like the direct-to-consumer EEG devices have sort of slid under the radar a bit. Mm. But they're out there, they're being marketed to consumers, and again, like you said, with the idea that you can read, you know, if you wear these things, they're going to read out your emotion or mental state, and by having access to that data, you can then improve your emotion or mental state or behavior. And what we did in the paper was not test individual devices, which I think would be a worthwhile endeavor, but was to say, what are the claims these companies are making, and what are the assumptions that would need to hold true if these claims were to be correct? And so we found that there's no good evidence that these consumer EEG devices, which are cheaper, have fewer electrodes than the research or laboratory grade devices that you mentioned.
Right.
There's no evidence that the data is valid or reliable.
Right.
And there's also no evidence, generally speaking, that having access to your brainwave data, even if it were to be correct, can help you improve your mental state. There's a bit of controversy around the neurofeedback literature, which claims that, but there's also there's not a lot of good studies in that space. So we kind of took aim at this industry. And it may be doing something, it may not be, but whatever it is, there definitely needs to be more evidence and published evidence, I'd say, in this space.
You know, one interesting piece of evidence, going back to the TDCS study that you did, users, I believe it was in that one, it might have been in the EEG, but users report using these products less frequently over time, which implicitly shows that they're not really affecting them in a way that they are noticing.
Yeah. I would love to do a study of users of these direct-to-consumer EEG devices, but in this case, I published something I was not so friendly first. I'm sure that I have a feeling they would not be into collaborating.
Oh, these companies must love you. Yeah.
But the EEG stuff is interesting. And I think, you know, given that this podcast is about AI and machine learning, right? So what can you glean from the EEG data? That's a really interesting question in neuroethics. And something I've been thinking about recently. I'm writing a commentary on another paper. You can get some stuff, and I think we're better than chance at detecting certain features. But I think there's a mistake.
What you're talking about with the DIY stuff, the consumer products?
No, I'm talking about with EEG.
Yeah, like consumer versions of the EEG or lab studies? Or?
I'd say lab versions of EEG. Hmm. So I think from the AI or computational perspective, what people try to show is detecting certain responses to certain events. Like I'm sure you're familiar with the ERP and the P300.
Yes. So an ERP is just this EEG data that's time averaged over multiple trials. And so you get to really see the time signature of when the electrical component is fluctuating in the data. Whereas EEG data itself is super noisy. So it's just squiggles across the screen. And on a trial by trial basis, you can't really discern anything from it. Well, there's work being done on that. But the ERP, yes, is just averaged over time, which kind of filters out the noise.
Right. And so there's certain... Sorry, are you familiar with the P300?
Yeah, there are all these different names of components of that ERPs are associated with different cognitive processes. And you're trying my memory here, but the P300, that is not the awareness component, is it?
That's the aha wave, the...
Surprise?
The surprise or recognition or the stimulus, the reaction to this stimulus is different than the other stimulus. Like this is the, think of a number from 1 to 10 in your head. Okay, let's say I'm thinking number 5.
Uh-huh.
The P300 will look different, supposedly, when, you know, let's say you flash all the numbers across the screen, when the 5
when
is
the
flashed.
When the 5, oh, I see, the recognition.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But there's a lot of other studies with P300 too that I can't just conjure, but there's, so it's a well-studied ERP component.
Super well-studied, yeah.
But I'm just a brain scientist, so I can't name them, of course.
Anyway, there's a lot of people talking now about the P3. So the P300 is this inadvertent response to certain stimuli, right? I mean, it's inadvertent in the sense that I can't control my P300.
Right.
So there's been quite a few studies from the computer science world that have looked into whether you can hack someone's brain, whether the P300 can reveal information that the subject might not have told you. So the thing I want to just point out is that in those studies, better than chance is a good measure, and those studies are considered successful from the point of those researchers or
statistically better than chance.
Statistically better than chance, right? So let's say I held a digit from 0 to 9 in my head, you would have a 1 in 10 chance of guessing that digit on the first try, right? So you'd have a 10% chance of guessing that first try. If there's an algorithm that shows that using the P300 and showing me a bunch of stimuli on the screen, and I'm holding a number in my head, that shows that if the algorithm has a 20% chance of guessing correctly on the first try, then the algorithm is performing better than chance, which is 10%.
Okay.
So that's all to say, but at the same time, it's still 80% incorrect on the first try. The point is that all this stuff is exciting, but I feel like a lot of neuroethicists have misread, and I think some more hype than has been warranted has been generated around studies that have shown better than chance ability.
Yeah, you don't want, if you're skydiving, you don't want to only pull the parachute slightly better than chance.
Right.
For it to be really useful, we need it to be reliable.
Right. So all that to say, machine learning is really, so I think machine learning and AI will really come into play with EEG, although I don't know if EEG will ever, I don't know if EEG is ever going to get a good enough signal to be totally reliable.
I think that we disagree on that.
You think EEG?
Yeah, but well, because there's already single trial. I mean, given enough electrodes. I mean, there's a lot of factors with the noise and the electrical signal and the impedance and all of this stuff that we don't need to get into. I think I'm more optimistic about using all of the electrodes as data points that, you know, single trial activity could be pretty accurate eventually. But I don't know. I could be convinced otherwise.
Do you think there would ever be an easy setup of an EEG?
Like home setup?
Yeah, that it would be that. Because if you really have all the electrodes, you're getting good contact. I see that I can go like possibly there, but
I think that if you, I mean, this is just shooting from the hip, but I think that if your EEG cap also contained a shielding cap over it, right, where you can shield the noise from mm-hmm. the external world, and somehow that would improve things, you know. But I mean, this was sort of on my agenda to work on before I left academia.
Really?
Well, I was just interested in it because I had done monkey neurophysiology, so I was interested in getting into the EEG world, and because that would also broaden my prospects for a job, an academic faculty position. Uh-huh. So, and brain waves oscillations had been interesting to me. I'd read a lot about them, and I didn't quite get there. I was stuck, mired in monkey neurophysiology, recording their brain activity.
Hmm.
But you have an infant though. You want to hear my entrepreneurial idea? This is, I had this right when I had an infant. So
sure.
It's a baby EEG cap. So you strap the thing on and you got to train it. But its job is to tell you, oh, the baby's about to fall asleep for this long. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Could you do that?
I haven't tried it yet, you know, so, but to, like, predict the duration of a nap. You might be able to, based on like sleep spindles and some of the neural signatures of as your brain goes into deeper sleep and things like that. I don't know. Or I can at least prepare you. Baby's about to wake up. You better come out of your euphoria, you know.
Yeah, I think you could do that. I mean, sleep and EEG, that's a very well characterized.
And useful. Mothers across the world would be purchased these things. So you need to get the regulation going before I start selling this, is what I'm saying.
You could. There's companies now selling home EEG devices for improving sleep. So you could just,
yeah,
no regulation. So if you say cure insomnia, then you're in trouble. If you say improve the quality of sleep.
What about induced lucid dreaming? Because I actually have a friend who's working on this. So yeah, he's really into lucid dreaming. And so yeah, it's fine. Do it.
I think that would be, yeah, there's one company that's out there that markets, I've seen like increased lucid dreaming or something like that.
Yeah, there's plenty on Kickstarter and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, is neurohacking here to stay? Is this just a fad, or is this something that's just going to continue?
It's a good question. I mean, we've seen neurohacking more broadly could mean, you know, trying to improve ourselves, trying to optimize our performance, trying to optimize our cognition. Do you mean this broader thing? Or
I mean the more narrow. Let's stick with the EEG and TDCS world. I mean, you know, these kinds of technologies, it's going to get more and more invasive, and eventually there's going to be brain chips, or is there going to be backlash and people are going to back off, or, you know, or is it just an inevitable progression here?
So I'm a skeptic. So I don't think at this stage that people will get invasive, that the consumers are going to buy into invasive neurotechnology, so neurotechnology that requires surgery
mm-hmm.
for enhancement purposes, for recreational and enhancement purposes. There may be a subculture of people who do that.
Hell, there already is.
Yeah. Well, the subculture, not in the brain.
Not in the brain,
but by,
yeah.
Right. Biohacking, grinder, whatever they're called, that world, certainly. But I think what we're going to see is that it probably remains a subculture. That might be modulated by whether or not these technologies turn out to be really effective or not. And, you know, as I've seen in my studies, it's not a technology that people find to be overwhelmingly effective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that's going to hamper its spread. and you know, when this technology first came out, there was a fear, oh my God, it's going to be widespread. Everyone's going to be hacking their brains. It's going to become widespread. People are going to be forced to use it. And that's really not what we've seen. So now we have some, you know, started in 2012, let's say. So now we could look back and see that it hasn't achieved widespread uptake. There may be a new technology, though, that comes out that's better, that's more effective, that has a direct-to-consumer version. And it may be a different story for that. I don't think it'll be the case with TDCS, at least not in the near future with EEG, I would say.
No way. Well, yeah, I totally agree.
I'm a skeptic.
Yeah.
I'm a skeptic when it comes to EEG.
Okay, well, let me flip this around then, because so we are, as humans, we are notoriously terrible at predicting the future. But I'd like you to predict the future. So, you know, is there what is something? Can you name something that you believe will come true in the neuroscience, brain stimulation, neurohacking, AI, that may seem far fetched, even though you're a skeptic? Is there something you think? Oh, I bet this is going to happen.
Where I see the most promising research going is with machine learning for really good quality data and for more invasive. So both like MRI, fMRI, MEG, I'm not talking about consumer neurotechnology.
Yep,
I'm talking about laboratory, research grade, high quality. Those are neuroimaging techniques that I mentioned. You could also think about ECOG going just inside the brain. I think that there's really amazing potential there for machine learning in AI, but those are really high quality signals.
Right.
So there's the study from Jack Gallant, is that his name? His lab with...
I think it's Gallant, isn't it? It might
Gallant.
Be Gallant. I'm not sure.
Yeah, probably Gallant. I met him. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. But in reconstructing, right, those visual images from scenes that have been shown to... there was a few studies, like at least in one, there was they were showing YouTube videos or something like that.
Yeah, I'm about to invite a speaker. I haven't emailed him yet, but just on this very topic. And so hopefully we can get into it and how it all works. So
yeah. But I think there's a lot of potential there. So where I'm skeptical is in the consumer versions, and in I'm skeptical of non-high fidelity recordings, or the fact that they'll ever make their way into the consumer realm. So I'm skeptical of the idea that we'll one day all be walking around with very accurate, very portable, lightweight monitoring devices that are going to read everything that we say.
So you're not prone to seeing the box of cereal, the Fruity Pebbles at the store, and it says, even fruitier. That doesn't make you pick it up?
No, I usually don't even get that kind of cereal.
I know, come on. All right, I was testing you.
I mean, I think it'll be interesting. And it'll be interesting to see what happens when there's a lot of money thrown at a problem. So Facebook and Neuralink throwing a lot of money at this. They're quiet about what they're working on, but overall they're working on consumer-facing BCIs.
Yeah.
I assume that's EEG. They're throwing a lot of money at it. They don't have the restrictions that academia has.
Right.
So I think there'll be progress there. But I'm skeptical in the sense that this is a problem that people have been working on for decades now. And there's, you know, there may be hard limitations to gleaning, you know, lots of rich personal information from consumer EEG products.
Well, we will see. Maybe we'll see. Who knows? But, Anna, what's something that you wish was on your CV that's not yet?
That's a very good question. A book.
Ah, a book. I know it's in the future because you write a lot.
Maybe in the future, maybe not, given that I'm on the academic track.
Yeah. Last question here. So what's something that you either don't have time or the resources to work on but you wish someone else would be working on? If you could, you'd be working on.
These are really good questions coming from someone who used to interview people. It's a very good question. Does it have to be related to science?
No.
It would be a charity or a nonprofit that would help American kids who've graduated high school. It would support them as they spent a year traveling around the world instead of going straight to college.
That would be so cool. That's a great answer.
I've always wanted to do that.
She is Anna Wexler. You can find more information about her at annawexler.com. Thanks for talking with me, Anna, and thanks for going so long. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, sorry. It gives you more work in the edit. I didn't hear about the RV.
What was
the highlight of the RV? And how do you answer those two tough questions? Because those are really tough questions that you put forward.
I don't have to answer them, so.
Yeah. Brain Inspired is a production of me. You can support the show through Patreon for a trifling $2 or $4 per month. Go to patreon.com/braininspired or go to the website braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. Your contribution will help keep this show going without any annoying advertisements like you hear on other shows. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thank you for your support. See you next time. The stereo.